extermination or for some policy to support the state. So the most important, not discussed issue of our time right now is the liberation of the human condition and what it is to be human, because a lot of us don't know anymore, because we've been so damaged by the technology that's been inserted into the public. I mean, you've spoken to enough people and watched culture close enough yourself to see that what's been done to our children just by the interfacing of technology in their development years. What, you know, a lot of children grew up with a cell phone in their hand. That's a completely different reality and a different nervous system. Their nervous systems have been retuned for something else. They've been retuned to blend in so that their memories and personality will be on the cloud in the future. So the big discussion is, and should be all over the world, is where are we going, what are we doing, and why are we doing it based upon a few people's idea of what a human being should be.
It's really amazing what you're saying. Do you have any final thoughts?
Freedom of your mind and the liberation of the human condition, this is the high ground of the military-industrial complex and the New World Order. And if you do not, and people do not, address these issues, now you're not going to have free will. You're not going to have freedom. You're not going to have a right to rule and create a future that you want. This is, a lot of people have sacrificed to bring this information to the public a long time ago, and people have really put themselves out there because they know at this moment in our history, this is the crossroads of either the beginning and liberation of the human condition or the complete and total slavery of it. So I would suggest everybody start to examine it and take a real close look at it and start taking action from themselves. Don't expect any elected employee to do anything, because they've failed miserably, totally, completely. Specifically, I'm talking about the United States. Take it upon the individual self to take control of their own reality, take full responsibility, and then move ahead. That's what I suggest. That's my leading parting message for everybody.
Well, thank you very much, James Martinez, for a very interesting discussion. Well, listening to Mr. Martinez can only make us wonder how controlled all of our minds are right now. We're also connected to our screens. Is this the new form of brainwashing? Well, the original sin of torturing people and destroying thousands of lives was really never addressed. There were some families who were compensated, but the majority were not. And of course, the victims can never, ever be fully compensated. Now, this brings up the question that although the CIA says its MKUltra program no longer exists, what would stop it from using other inhumane techniques to reach a goal? It used biological warfare in the past and never really had to pay for it. What does that mean for us today? Are they in the business of creating germ warfare? It was said that the MKUltra program was so extensive that it even developed biological weapons in the form of aerosol sprays, and that all types of poisons and drugs were created, combined, and tested on humans. And that was then, in the 1950s and 60s. What about now?
March 16th, 2018. The U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, commonly known as DARPA, announces a bold initiative to develop what they call next-generation non-surgical neurotechnology. It is designed to allow the human brain to directly interface with machines.
We know that DARPA is exploring human-machine interfaces that include direct connections between the brain and outside systems. That's been from the beginning of DARPA's information technology mission, and it continues to this day. DARPA has created some of the most influential technologies of all time, things that we use and take for granted every day, including the project that became the internet. They've created self-driving cars, stealth technology, GPS that fits in your pocket. That's DARPA's specialty, to imagine the future and create it.
A new technology that is actually very much on the verge of being a reality that is being fielded is we could have a sensor maybe on the surface of our head, or maybe implanted somewhere in our body, in our brain or something, that allows us to interact directly with our communications gear, our processing gear, our weapon systems, and so on. But now imagine we take that technology and we can control robots at a distance with it. Even fly drones. You put this sensor on and you think the right way, and you can increase the speed of the fan by thinking and controlling that thought with direct-to-mind or mind-machine interfacing. With that type of capability, you could control all sorts of buttons and mechanisms in equipment.
Mind-machine interfaces will have many applications in both civilian and military life. But there are those who believe that this same technology could also be used by DARPA as a new form of mind control. Like their counterparts at the CIA, DARPA-funded researchers have spent decades investigating how the human mind can be altered. In 1965, DARPA launched Project Pandora, which studied the possibility of using microwave radiation to control human behavior. The project reportedly ended in 1969, but DARPA's investigation of how machines can affect and possibly control the brain continues to this day.
750,000 dollars. That's how much the Olson family was compensated for the assassination of Frank Olson by the CIA back in 1975, which is ironic because it seems the only murder that was compensated and apologized for in this manner was the murder of a scientist who himself was guilty of creating bioweapons, responsible for the murder of many others. Well, in Canada alone, of the 300 victims who filed for compensation, 250 were turned down with the excuse of not having been affected badly enough, or for filing too late, or for the lack of medical records, which the CIA had conveniently destroyed. But these victims are only a fraction of those who were severely injured and killed by the similar scientific experiments on human beings without their knowledge and consent. Because in addition to these human guinea pigs and the some 7,000 U.S. soldiers used for these experiments, there were thousands more who paid the price for the projects approved by the American government. People in Korea and elsewhere who received the final product which resulted from these experiments. The most voiceless victims of the CIA's biological warfare were these non-Americans whose suffering didn't seem to be an area of concern, as they were citizens of the so-called enemy countries. You see, the most dangerous brainwashing method is not that which was done using LSD and other drugs and terror techniques, but the media propaganda that dictates to people every single day which lives should matter and which ones are simply all the expendables. Perhaps it's time for us to unplug ourselves from all the noise from the screens and give our minds time to process what is reality and what is a creation of cyberspace. Be able to discern the real from the created is the test of the day. And depending on how well we score, it can help determine if we can free our minds or simply behave like a puppet on a string, giving in to the whims and directions of others on the web. Well, with that, it brings us to the end of this week's show. And we hope you will be joining us for our next Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, low-income households will spend on average £200 more on bills than last year, the consumer body Which? Has warned. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Some of the United Kingdom's least well-off households could be left more than £200 worse off on their energy bills this year because of reduced government support, the consumer body Which? Has warned. Joining calls made by other campaigners, it said the government urgently needed to introduce a social tariff for gas and electricity to protect the most financially vulnerable. Consumers have been spared an increase to their energy costs equivalent to £500 on the typical annual bill originally planned to come in from 1st of April until a government U-turn. However, a separate scheme that provided all households with a £400 discount, giving them £66 or £67 off their energy bills every month from October of 2022 through to March of 2023 inclusive, has just come to an end. Which said that even with the government's decision to keep the energy price guarantee at £2,500 for an average household until July rather than putting it up to £3,000, millions of low-income consumers would still face higher energy bills this financial year. While analysts have predicted that annual energy bills could typically fall to about £2,000 from this summer, consumers will still be paying almost double what they were paying before the energy crisis began. Which predicted that these factors combined will mean the poorest 10% of households in Britain will have to spend an average of £209 more on energy this financial year compared to last year. It said the average low-income consumer used less energy than those on higher incomes, so they would not benefit as much from the anticipated falls in energy prices, but would still feel the full loss of the £400 of additional government support. Higher costs could be particularly difficult to manage for prepayment meter users, many of whom are on low incomes, because, unlike direct debit customers, they cannot spread their costs across the whole year and so would see a spike in costs during the cold winter months. Which said ministers had announced the cost of living payments to those on qualifying benefits would continue, but added, this will leave low-income households who are struggling to make ends meet but do not qualify for benefits out in the cold. A properly targeted social tariff, a discounted energy rate for those most in need, was desperately needed, it added. Calls for a social tariff have been growing louder, with Citizens Advice and the consumer champion Martin Lewis among those increasing pressure on the British government over the issue. A recent study suggested such a tariff could save 12 million households on the lowest income an average of £381 a year, and up to £1,500 in some cases. The government has announced a package of cost of living support, including a £900 cash boost for more than 8 million eligible means-tested benefit claimants. including people on universal credit, pension credit, and tax credits, to be paid into bank accounts in 3 installments between this spring and spring of 2024. Site irishnews.com has also covered this story and tells us more. Consumer groups have called for an energy social tariff in the form of cash payments for the poorest households ahead of what they warn could be a decade of high bills. Citizens Advice said payments of up to £1,500 are now an essential long-term solution for millions of fuel-poor households, both now and during what could be a decade of record prices. The call for targeted financial support by next year has the backing of a coalition of consumer and energy bodies, including Martin Lewis and Energy UK, and is part of a new report commissioned by Citizens Advice, following 9 months of consultation with industry and the public. The report recommends cash payments according to individual household need, delivered through a combination of HMRC data on household incomes and energy supplier knowledge of how much electricity and gas is used to show a picture of who needs help and by how much. More than 12 million British households on the lowest income would qualify for support, and the average qualifying household would see their energy bill reduced by £381, with some getting up to £1,500, according to the report's analysis. Currently, households are spending more than twice as much on energy compared with 18 months ago, regardless of whether the government's energy price guarantee remains at £2,500, as is widely expected, rather than rises to the previously announced £3,000 from April. If the energy price guarantee remains at £2,500, 10 million households will face crisis-level energy costs, with more than 10% of their income after housing costs going to energy, a key indicator of fuel poverty, the charity said. If the energy price guarantee increases to £3,000, that figure rises to 12 million households, it warned. People on the lowest income will be hit much harder, with energy make up more than half of their total household income after housing costs in either scenario, up from 34% in 2019. Citizens Advice said it helped 50% more people with energy issues last year than the year before, and more than double that of 2020. Last year, it saw more people who could not afford to top up their prepayment meter than in the previous 10 years combined. The charity warned energy prices are not expected to return to pre-pandemic levels for the next decade. The report also calls for a national programme of loft and cavity wall insulation for all households in fuel poverty. Citizens Advice Chief Executive Dame Claire Moriarty said, "Energy affordability is a long-term problem that needs a long-term solution. A social tariff protects millions of people from spending excessive amounts on their energy bills. High energy costs have left too many people choosing between heating and eating. Uncertainty over future high prices only adds to the stress and worry felt in households across the country. This policy helps make energy bills more affordable in the years ahead and supports the shift to warmer, safer homes that are ready for the net zero transition."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the Newsline.
More than 830 UK health professionals and representatives from leading medical bodies have signed a letter to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, expressing grave concerns that the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda will cause catastrophic mental and physical harm to people seeking safety. The letter says, subjecting people seeking sanctuary in the UK, many of whom have mental health conditions and have histories of torture, trafficking and trauma, to such an inhumane process is a matter of significant concern for the medical community. Like Brexit, the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda has split the UK down the middle. According to a poll carried out by a think tank this month, almost half of those surveyed back the deal. The scheme, which would see the UK pay Rwanda $145 million over the next 5 years, has faced backlash from NGOs, asylum seekers, and a civil service trade union that questions its legality, leading the government to delay its execution. Under the government's illegal migration bill, the ones who do make it to the UK won't be admissible to have their asylum claim assessed, even if they are refugees coming from war-torn societies. Instead, they will face immediate removal either to their country of origin or a third country like Rwanda. The government's plan comes as most of the asylum seekers qualify to have their claims considered in the UK under international law, and the government cannot declare them inadmissible forcefully. The government insists that the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is workable and an essential deterrent to prevent large numbers of people crossing the channel. So far, no flights have taken place after the first scheduled flight to the African nation was stopped at the 11th hour back in June, due to an intervention by the European Court of Human Rights, followed by months of legal challenges which have since stalled the program. Last year, a record 45,756 people crossed the channel in small boats. So far this year, more than 5,000 have made the crossing, a similar figure to this time last year before the Rwanda announcement was made. In December, the High Court in London ruled the British government's plan to send thousands of migrants to Rwanda lawful. But that decision is being challenged by asylum seekers. At the start of a four-day hearing on Monday, the refugees' lawyers argued that the plan is unlawful because the East African country is not safe. The lawyers told the court that the government had failed to tread the line between deterring migrants and remaining within Britain's human rights obligations. However, lawyers representing the British government stressed that its deal with Rwanda is subject to an exacting set of monitoring arrangements, including by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who has intervened in the appeal. Rwanda says migrants will be treated with respect and dignity, and the deal will offer them better opportunities. One of the three judges hearing the case said the issue of the safety of Rwanda would be the core issue. The charity Freedom from Torture, which is intervening as a third party in the appeal after having provided the High Court with evidence during deliberations last year, said Home Secretary Suella Braverman's policy poses a risk. Separately, two charities are warning that the illegal migration bill could lock up thousands of refugee children who have become separated from their parents. According to an impact assessment by the Refugee Council, it estimates that about 15,000 unaccompanied children would have their asylum claims deemed inadmissible in the first 3 years of the implementation of the legislation. As a result, those children could be detained or face deportation to the country they have fled or a third country, such as Rwanda. They could also be banned from remaining in the UK as refugees when they turn 18.
fighting persists in Sudan despite several ceasefire agreements between the army and the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The deadly conflict, which has so far claimed hundreds of lives and displaced many others, has brought much of the country's vital infrastructure to a standstill. Water and power have been cut and hospitals are damaged and closed.
The situation's very, very tense. No one really knows what is happening. It doesn't sound like it's de-escalating at all. And any attempts to have a humanitarian ceasefire have failed, it seems. So it's unclear what's going to happen next.
People find it almost impossible to provide their basic necessities. Weary residents must stand in line for bread in neighborhoods largely emptied of civilian life. Many are trapped or stranded in their homes, risking theft and looting if they venture out.
It hasn't. We can't sleep. We haven't slept in the past 4 days. We try to catch a few naps here and there, but it's not helping at all. We haven't left our house.
In the suburbs of three main cities of Khartoum, Bahri, and Omdurman, where are scenes of heavy clashes, people lock suitcases long distances by foot towards bus stops as they try to flee those areas and seek refuge in countries like Chad and South Sudan. According to UN estimates, some 2,000 Sudanese have so far arrived in South Sudan, most of them women and children. Non-stop airstrikes, shelling, and gun battles have ripped across the city day and night. The RSF says it has embedded itself in several neighborhoods, taking over buildings and other residential places. The army, on the other side, has used airstrikes and heavy artillery to try to force its rivals back. Army officials said they are trying to clear what they called hotbeds of rebel groups from the capital, Khartoum. Heavy gunfire and deadly airstrikes have prompted so many countries to withdraw their citizens and nationals from the Northeast African nation. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, France, Turkey, the Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, the UK, the US, and so many other countries have already evacuated their citizens or have deployed soldiers and provided flights to secure their return. Some other nations, including Canada, have suspended their operations in Sudan amid heavy fighting there. The decision by many of world countries to evacuate their citizens from Sudan comes more than a week after clashes broke out between rival forces, the army led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the RSF commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hemeti. The cause of the conflict? Tensions over the planned integration of RSF into Sudan's regular army. Many around the globe have warned that the conflict could plunge the country into a deeper chaos. This comes to the spotlight, especially when outside forces are further complicating the situation by providing arms or other military and financial assistance to either of the warring sides there. But what help would withdrawing foreign nationals from Sudan provide? Many argue that with foreign countries evacuating their diplomatic staff, it will be easier to put pressure on armed rivals to agree to a longer and more effective ceasefire. That, however, raises questions as to whether the conflict, which is merely an existential power struggle on both sides, as many put it, will ever come to an end. Observers believe it is very unlikely that the two military commanders will ever come to the negotiating table and resolve differences. With that possibility being in the sight, there are national and international ramifications regarding the conflict. On the international level, one major consequence would be the exodus of refugees all moving toward the borders of Europe. That will eventually create a huge burden for the European countries, which are already grappling with the fallout of the US wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, or Libya and many other countries for that matter, with influx of migrants seeking refuge there. Maybe that's why world countries, especially those in Europe and Sudan's neighbors, must join hand in hand to bring this deadly conflict to an end. At home, the longer they battle it out in city streets, the higher the civilian toll will climb and the harder it will be for either general to rule over the wreckage. If not, it can be expected that a major tragedy will be just around the corner. What seems to be of high urgency for Sudan is that this country, which has been the hotbed of back-to-back military coups, has to be ruled by a civilian-led democracy. something that the Sudanese people have long been calling for and for which they have paid a heavy price. Israel is on the decline. That's what the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, highlighted during a meeting with ambassadors of Islamic nations in the Iranian capital Tehran on Saturday. Ayatollah Khamenei further underlined that the deterrent power of the Israeli regime is coming to an end. The leader said several decades ago, Ben-Gurion, one of the founders of the fake regime, said we'll be destroyed whenever our deterrent power ends. The world is currently witnessing this reality, and if nothing happens, the end of the usurping regime is close. The leader said this, too, is one of the blessings that has risen from the sacrifices of the devoted Palestinian youth in the West Bank and other occupied areas. The leader regarded the internal resistance of the Palestinian people and the risk-taking, sacrificing nature of its youth as the main causes of the miserable situation that exists in the Israeli regime. He said today's situation in the occupied territories proved that the more the Palestinians stand up and resist in different regions, the weaker the fake regime will become. Describing efforts by the Palestinian resistance movements as valuable, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the resistance fronts and all Islamic countries should focus on strengthening the fighting elements inside Palestine. The leader pointed to the increasing support for the Palestinians around the globe, saying the participation of the Europeans in rallies to support the Palestinian people is very important, especially in countries that are dependent on the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei said anti-Israeli gatherings in the US and European countries are the result of the increasing revelations of the crimes of the regime in Tel Aviv. The leader further referred to the pioneership of the Islamic Republic in supporting the Palestinian issue, saying this movement will continue. He expressed hope that the beloved people of Iran will witness a day when Muslims of all Islamic countries will pray freely in Al-Quds. The remarks by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution come at a time when the Israeli regime is facing challenges both internally and externally. In the occupied territories, the regime has been witnessing months of protests and strikes in response to its push for broad judicial reforms. Protests have been taking place in a number of cities, including Tel Aviv, with demonstrators calling for the resignation of the entire Israeli cabinet. The protests all erupted after cabinet officials announced their decision to limit the Supreme Court's power. Protesters argued that the changes will foster corruption and bring about this isolation. The protests, with hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people participating in the weekly event, have become a huge burden for Israeli authorities. Some argue that the regime has ignited its own annihilation by proposing such reforms. Other than that, political parties in Israel had previously failed to win the majority of votes to form a cabinet. That's, of course, before Netanyahu came to power after several back-to-back elections in 4 entire years. Even now that the Israeli premier has finally managed to form a coalition, there is no guarantee that it will survive given all the crises it is facing. In the occupied territories, the regime has been carrying out almost daily raids into numerous Palestinian neighborhoods, killing and injuring them. Not to mention that most of those killed are teenagers and youths. The regime has also carried out raids into a number of religious sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, triggering retaliatory attacks from Palestinians. From rocket attacks carried out from the Gaza Strip to shooting and car ramming operations in the occupied West Bank, the regime has been witnessing a strong resistance from Palestinians. After all, they're dealing with a generation that has literally nothing to lose and is ready to fight for its land, which has been taken away from its ancestors decades ago. On the international level, the regime is getting more isolated day after day by many countries around the globe, including those in Europe, with their capitals calling on the regime to put an end to its atrocities against Palestinians. The Israeli land grab and the subsequent illegal settlements in the occupied land are just a few among all the many crimes world countries are reacting against. Not to mention that the years-long Israeli blockade on Gaza has added to global anger against the regime. More broadly, with actions like boycott, divestment, sanctions, the BDS movement, which is a global decision to boycott Israeli products, it seems that the world countries are determined to further isolate the regime from different fronts. Maybe that's exactly what Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei refers to as the imminent end of the usurping Israeli regime.
He's called a wolf warrior. That is how China's new ambassador to the U.S. has been described. The hawkish Qin Gang, a close confidant of President Xi Jinping, enters the scene in Washington at a time of high tensions between China and the U.S. If the United States does not hit the brakes, but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing, and there will surely be conflict and confrontation, he said. Qin Gang couldn't be more direct. With a statement like that, he set the tone for China's foreign policy for the coming year and beyond, and it couldn't be more combative. That should be no surprise. Chinese warnings have become normal, whereas in the past, it would spell a crisis. Just the other day, the Chinese Foreign Ministry threatened the U.S., saying that we will not allow anyone to interfere in bilateral relations between Beijing and Moscow. The U.S. is now getting a taste of his own medicine. After all, the U.S. has provoked China militarily and economically, and otherwise for that matter. The former Chinese ambassador to the U.S. has said China has never wanted to play a zero-sum game with the U.S. At a time when relations between the number one and two economies couldn't be worse, the foreign policies of these two superpowers are on opposite trajectories. China is moving full steam ahead. It has enhanced its standing on the global stage, and many of its directives go against U.S. interests, though unintentionally. When it comes to its national currency, the yuan, China spared no efforts to internationalize it, threatening the role of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. Take the latest visit by the Brazilian president to China. Lula da Silva called on developing countries to work towards replacing the U.S. dollar with their own currencies in international trade. De-dollarization also held true when the Chinese president recently visited Saudi Arabia and asked the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf to buy their commodities from China with the yuan. In another blow to the U.S., China was the final mediator between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which dealt a heavy blow to U.S.'s standing, not just when it came to its ally Saudi Arabia, but also in West Asia. The BRICS grouping of nations comprised of Russia, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa is another example of not only China's growing clout in countries supporting it, but how, when it comes to trade blocs, the U.S. is left behind. Let's not forget, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Argentina, and Algeria have also applied for membership. In addition to BRICS, other trade blocs which do not include the U.S. are RCEP, the SCO, and the EEU, the Eurasia Economic Union. And in an unprecedented move, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced recently actions to limit U.S. investments in China. Biden's executive order will limit U.S.-China economic engagement, as the measures would entail U.S. businesses restricting their investments in key parts of the Chinese economy. The U.S. is gradually losing its allies, like European ones, when it comes to the Ukraine war, as demonstrated by this stance by the French president after visiting China. These U.S. moves, however, are by design, since the U.S.'s ultimate goal is confronting China militarily in the South China Sea to provoke China the same way that it did Russia. That is, if the U.S. does not lose its proxy war in Ukraine. Which brings us to a suggestion by the former U.S. ambassador to China to the current officials of the White House, including the U.S. president.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to Britain's Centre for National Statistics, 77% of British adults over the age of 16 feel they are very worried about the rising cost of living. Of these respondents, 50% said they worry almost every day. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Yorkshire Post has covered this story and tells us more. A survey from one leading UK youth charity found that half of young people in London have had their mental health negatively impacted by the cost of living crisis. The polling from UK Youth, which was carried out on 16 to 25-year-olds in Greater London, also revealed a number of concerns around loneliness, home heating and access to food. UK Youth is focused on supporting young people in the United Kingdom with an open network of more than 8,000 youth organisations and nation partners. Britain's cost of living crisis refers to the fall in real disposable income since late 2021, caused by a number of coinciding factors, such as the war in Ukraine and ongoing economic problems following the COVID-19 pandemic. The chief executive of UK Youth, Ndidi Okezie, OBE, said, "These figures must be a wake-up call for our country. Our young people are struggling in the face of the cost of living crisis and they need help." She added, "Youth organisations who provide essential support to young people are also on their knees. The situation cannot be allowed to continue as it is." A separate UK Youth survey found nearly two-thirds of youth organisations, or 63%, are seeing increased demand for services from young people, with a similar figure, 67%, facing increased operating costs. According to UK Youth, more than 8 in 10 young people, or 82% in London, are concerned about the impact of the cost of living crisis on their ability to get a secure job now and also in the future. More than 8 in 10 parents, or 84% of parents in Britain, worry that the cost of living crisis will impact their child's future, with almost three-quarters of those concerned, 74%, believing better or increased access to youth work would help. UK Youth, which launched a new £5 million grant fund last February in partnership with Piers Foundation to support youth organisations through the cost of living crisis, is calling for greater government investment into young people in Britain. Code 7 Limited is one youth organisation to have been awarded a grant of £17,000 a year for 3 years by the charity to help it cope with the cost of living crisis. Its chief executive officer, Peter St. Aubin, said, "We're doing our best to support as many young people and young families as possible, but council services are shrinking and people need us more than ever." He added, "One mother told us the other day that one of her child's socks went missing in the wash and she can't afford to buy a new pair." He said, "It seems like a small thing, but to a child who can't go to school in matching socks is a shocking indication of where things are." Martin Spears, director of the DOST Centre, which has been awarded £8,300 a year for 3 years by UK Youth, said, "We spend twice what we used to on food to accommodate the growing numbers," he said. "We're also seeing more and more young people coming to us, which means more staff and more resources are needed." UK Youth claims there has been a decade of cuts to the sector, with local authorities spending 77% less on youth services, a £1 billion real terms decrease, leading to the closure of several hundred of youth clubs and the loss of thousands of highly skilled youth work jobs. The charity, Dorset Centre, is urging the government, together with local councils, businesses and community funders, to guarantee quality youth work provision for young people across the United Kingdom. Britain's national broadcaster ITV Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. A new survey found vulnerable young people are struggling to keep their lives on track because of rising cost of living. Figures show 55% of people surveyed in the northwest of England are worried about eviction due to increased cost of living. And three quarters said they're struggling to afford the basics, including food, heating and travel. Jason, not his real name, is a 20-year-old who lives in Manchester. He has been surviving on benefits and says he regularly goes without food and heating because he simply can't afford the basics. Jason has to use the shower at his uncle's house most days as it costs too much to use at his own flat. He hates having to do this as he feels he's a burden on his family, and a constant struggle to make ends meet has affected his mental health, making him withdrawn and depressed. He says this has all come about because of the cost of living crisis. The cost of living is so much more expensive these days. There are thousands of young people in the United Kingdom who are unable to pay for their basics and are at risk of becoming homeless because they cannot afford their rent. Simone Newman from DePaul, UK, said, "We're witnessing the effects of the cost of living crisis daily. What's so worrying is the huge threat to the futures of young people across the northwest of England, especially those trying hard to rebuild their lives after homelessness. If a young person can't make ends meet, they risk eviction and the devastating possibility of returning to homelessness." Simone Newman said, "We cannot allow this to happen because out there they are exposed to increased risks around criminal exploitation, poor mental health and loss of hope for a better future. We urgently need donations to cover the increased costs to support young people experiencing homelessness." Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered this story. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, "We must continue with our efforts to drive down inflation so we can ease pressure on families and businesses." Jeremy Hunt claimed, we are on track to do this. With the OBR forecasting, we will halve inflation this year and will continue supporting people with a cost of living support worth an average of £3,300 per household over this year and last year, funded through windfall taxes on energy profits. DePaul have launched an appeal to raise money to help young people in crisis. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said recently food inflation in the UK hit a 45-year high of 19.1% in March. The latest inflation report revealed that food and non-alcoholic drink prices saw their highest rate of inflation in over 45 years, up from 18% per year in February. The cost of food alone surged 19.6%, with notable increases in the prices of bread, cereal, meat, fish, milk, eggs, olive oil, vegetables and fruit. Bread and cereal prices jumped a whopping 19.4%, while meat prices were up 17.4%. Whole milk prices rose 37.9%, while egg prices climbed 32%. The price of olive oil ballooned 49.2% compared to last year due to supply disruptions caused by the war in Ukraine. Additionally, vegetable oil rose from 19.3% and fruit prices rose 10.6%. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said that the last time food prices were this high was back in August of 1977, when inflation was estimated at the time at 21.9%.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with a number of poets and experts in Persian literature in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on Wednesday, April 5, 2023. The meeting took place on the eve of the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Da'bil al-Khuza'i recited his famous poem in Khurasan, and Imam Rida alayhi salam rewarded him with a jubba. Jubba is a long outer garment. Well, Da'bil left and went to Qom. The people in Qom told him, "We have heard that the Imam has given you a jubba. Give it to us." Da'bil said no. They kept insisting and asking him to give them a piece of it, but he refused. He left Qom with a caravan. Along the way, bandits, those who attacked caravans in the desert, came up to their caravan, stopped them, and took all their belongings from them. The chief of the bandits sat on top of a large rock above them, while the bandits were busy opening the bags of the caravan and taking their things one by one. As he was looking at his agents, he recited this verse, أرى فيئهم في غيرهم متقسما وأيديهم من فيئهم صفرات. The theme of the poem was that he was saying, I see that I am losing what is mine and that which belongs to me. The chief of the thieves was referring to the caravans. In other words, he was saying that they had lost their belongings. Their wealth was in someone else's hand. This was a verse from the ode that Da'bil had recited.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Da'bil told his caravan to go and ask him, the chief of the thieves, who that poem was from. One of the people in his caravan went to him and asked, who is this verse, the poem that you recited from? He said, it is from Da'bil. The person told him that Da'bil is here. Where? He asked They showed him Da'bal. Da'bal went forward and said, "Yes, this is my poem. I'm Da'bal." And the chief of the bandits ordered them to return everything they had taken from the caravan. What I want to say is that this is the meaning of media. This poem, for example, was recited in the month of Rajab in Khorasan. A thief memorized it in the month of Sha'ban, and he recited a verse from it as an analogy. This is how poems were circulated and spread. It was a form of media. The media today is different, of course, but poetry has its own place. No other media has that special effect that poetry does. Of course, some forms of media, like the cinema, and probably more influential than poetry, visual media and the like. But they finish and are forgotten. You watch a movie once, you want it twice, and it finishes. But poems remain. They remain for 1,000 years. This is a characteristic of poetry. Therefore, poetry is an effective, long-lasting medium.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU's industry and economy was built thanks to decades of cheap gas supply from Russia. Now the bloc has shut that supply off due to the war in Ukraine. A mild winter ensured reasonable energy storage was maintained in the EU, and prices, while very high, did not bring the bloc to breaking point. The US has made a fortune by exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas, to the 27-nation bloc. Lawmakers warn there could be greater competition for LNG in 2023.
If China were to return to 2021 LNG consumption levels, the EU could end up with a gap between demand and supply of 27 billion cubic meters, which is no small amount. Citizens need to be reassured. We can't just pray for another mild winter.
There have been calls during a European Parliament debate for the EU to urgently up its game regarding energy storage technology.
The EU has only a limited amount of storage capacity, with the majority of energy being stored in the form of pumped hydro, which has significant geographical limitations.
Experts warn that energy shortages in the coming months could push EU inflation through the roof. The bloc's leaders are looking towards Africa and the Middle East for supply, but that's a costly exercise.
The problem is that European leadership is not leading Europe to a better future. The problem is that they are servants of American lobby, and they're providing exclusively the interests of Americans. Iran